I'm Pitney.
And I'm Amelia.
And we're from
Pitney and Amelia's Bitchin' Boutique.
Who are we?
Why, we're your new best friends, of course.
Pull up a seat and listen in to what we think about people, places, and things.
Geeky stuff, horror movies, weirdos we know, spirituality, sexuality, food, filth.
It's like eavesdropping on the people at the next table for like an hour or so, and wishing you could join in on their conversation.
Also, do you see who just came in? Look at that hair.
Oh, honey, just... no.
Bitchiness, you're soaking in it.
We soften your hands while you do the dishes.
Pitney and Amelia's Bitchin' Boutique.
We're here.
We're queer. And
we're
in your ear.
Every other Friday, where all the classiest podcasts are found.
This podcast involves topics such as violence, sex, and mental illness. If this might disturb you or those around you, please reconsider. It's okay. Privacy and confidentiality have been protected, with personal information removed when possible. If you ever feel unsafe or suicidal, please call your local crisis center, emergency services, or national hotline. In the U.S., the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255. Once again, that's 1-800-273-8255. You matter.
Hey, this is Kate. When you were a kid, did you have dreams and aspirations about college? It's okay if the answer's no. I don't believe that everybody needs to or should go to college. It's not the right fit for everybody, and not every adult path, whether that involves career or just subsistence living, requires a degree. But if you did, and I did, I think as much because it was drilled into me by my parents as an independent just wanting to do so, but I imagined going to an Ivy League school, going to a prestigious name. How cool would that be? I ultimately did not. I didn't get in, for one, but I only applied to one. And the other ones I applied to, I just sort of realized this is just a stepping stone. I don't need to go to a perfect college to get the perfect degree. I have a long-term plan, and this school can get me there, so I'm going to go there. And I'm glad I did. I loved all three schools I attended after high school, and no regrets. But there is that thought about, do Ivy League schools matter? Is that an important thing to have there? Emblem and name on the top of your diploma. I've watched my kids apply for college and tried to tell them it doesn't matter that much. Like, it's a stepping stone, like I said, but society and parents and even high schools and teachers drill it in differently. So my guest today, his name is Sahaj Sharda. He's written a book about it. It's called The College Cartel, and it's about the interaction between capitalism and prestige and inherited wealth and connections and old white men and creating this concept of certain colleges inherently being better than others, creating a demand. And of course, there's a limited supply, and leaving the rest of us wondering, what am I missing out on? But also deciding, do we go there? Or is community college a good enough route, or even a better route to travel? Are you sure you really want to know? This is Ignorance Was Bliss.
Well, Kate, thanks so much for having me. My name is Sahaj Sharda for the audience, and I'm the author of an upcoming book titled The College Cartel. And the broad thesis of the book is that elite colleges in America collude in ways that are a violation of the antitrust laws and end up reducing the amount of seats available for students, jacking up the price beyond what is reasonable, and creating a stagnation in innovation in teaching, in quality, and all sorts of other things that you would sort of associate with dynamic and improving markets. And for all of those reasons, I think truly higher education is one of the most broken markets in America. And the book basically argues for thinking of this problem through the lens of antitrust and seeing if there aren't solutions through that lens.
That, you know, it's really an interesting thing for me. So I have taught at the college level myself, and my husband was a full-time college professor and until this past semester, and still teaches part-time colleges. And I fully agree that it's a broken system. It teaches students to think more narrowly rather than opening their mind. It's geared toward, you know, young white guys, basically. And, you know, women struggle to be there, people of color struggle to be there, people from disenfranchised groups, they're just sort of not made to feel welcome, much less made to feel smart or successful.
Yeah, look, I mean, I totally agree with all of those points. And, you know, one of the arguments I make in the book is one of the reasons that this is happening is because there's such a scarcity of seats, especially at the elite colleges, that the people who spend the most money in order to prepare their children to get in are the ones who often do. And what that does is it perpetuates, you know, the basically the demographics of yesteryear into the future. And it results in a completely stagnant campus environment where there's very little, you know, diversity in thought, where there's very little in terms of truly ambitious and socially mobile community. And instead, it's this sort of entrenchment of incumbents, of incumbent businesses, places like McKinsey, like Goldman, that disproportionately hire people from these schools. And it's the same faces that end up in the same places. And, you know, one of the things I argue in the book is, look, you're never going to be able to stop, you know, wealthy people from trying to preference their kids into these schools. But what these schools should have been doing this entire time is expanding their enrollments. So if you're Harvard and you have $55 billion in the bank, why are you using that money to invest in hedge funds or private equity? Why aren't you using it to build a second, third, fourth, and fifth campus? If you're so good at teaching, if your argument is we are the world's number one educational institution, why don't you want to teach more people? And I think, you know, sometimes the argument gets made that you can't do that without diluting the quality of students. I think that's completely ridiculous. I think there is a dramatic number of students in America and around the world who would really benefit from an elite first-class education who never get the chance to get in. For all sorts of reasons, the admission system is completely biased. And even if they did have a fair shot, there's so few seats to begin with that it's kind of like a crapshoot lottery. And all of these really incredible people who could be engines of prosperity for the country never get the opportunity. And so that's essentially, you know, the target that I'm going after in this book.
I would flail more if it would help people. Like, so, you know, I've taught at both small colleges and private bigger colleges. I don't want to name them only because it's been a hot minute since I've taught, and maybe they've changed. They haven't changed. We know they haven't changed. Like, I could go back to my alma mater. I graduated in 1998, and I guarantee it would feel and look the same as it does is now as it did then. But so my husband, the two of the chat classes that he's teaching, still part-time, one is at it's not an Ivy League, but I would consider it an elite private institution, and the other is a community college. And he talks about, you know, the private institution pays a lot better, so he does it because we got four kids, like, we like feeding right. them. That's a priority of ours. But he enjoys the community college a lot more because it's this diversity of students in terms of age, in terms of background, and, you know, demographics, all of the things. You don't want a bunch of 18-year-olds sitting in the room who they don't have a whole lot of life experience. They're not going to teach each other anything, much less, I mean, I'm coming at it for as much from a teacher angle as well as from the student angle. Like, as a teacher, it is more gratifying to see somebody succeed that maybe didn't think they were gonna. And as a student, of course, you know, we told our kids, because we've learned this, that like it doesn't matter what name is on your diploma, just if you want to go to school, go to school, start broad, and then narrow down. And so our second kid just started last semester at community college, and they certainly could have gotten into a more elite school, you know, based on their high school grades and that kind of thing. But they're like, no, I want to hear more points of view. And I'm like, something worked. We did something right. You know, and that's what they're saying, is like, the more diverse their classrooms are, the more they get out of it.
Right. And, you know, to your point, I would say, like, you know, when you go back through like the history of people who've had, you know, some of the biggest impacts on society, it's almost always, you know, sort of like diagonal. It's not people who've like followed the established path all the time. It's Einstein in the patents clerk's office, right? Doing sort of like minimum wage work, which is not where you would think that physics would be revolutionized. In fact, if people were laying bets, no one would have bet on Einstein. And I think similarly, no one would have bet on the Wright brothers, who basically owned a bicycle shop in Ohio and were messing around with aviation in their free time. I mean, some of the most interesting thinkers throughout history have been these sort of like polymath, generalist, interested in education for education's sake, you know, sort of autodidacts, self-taught people who can learn in any environment. But the willingness to learn is there. And, you know, one of the arguments I make in the book is, we now live in a world where with YouTube, with Google, there's more access to information than ever before. And so you would expect more people like Abraham Lincoln, sort of like self-taught, but quite comprehensively learned individuals, people who are able to take advantage of these tools and do something on their own. But for whatever reason, our society is stagnating in precisely the opposite way. There's such a focus on credentialism that people now get more and more degrees, get more and more schooling to achieve less and less. And this, to me, is one of the great challenges of our time, because I don't think degrees and education are the same thing. In fact, I think in a lot of ways, they're antonyms, not synonyms. And so in the book, I'm always talking about, well, if it is true that these pathways should be available, what's stopping it? And, you know, one of the arguments I make in the book is essentially there's such a focus on prestige, on signaling, on credentialism that is fostered largely by the elite schools that's very difficult for people to do anything else. And so that's certainly a theme I expound on in the book in quite a lot of detail.
So you talked about, you know, YouTube, obviously TikTok is insane, all of these other sources of information, podcasting, for instance.
Right.
Why a book? What made you decide this is how I'm going to get this information together?
Yeah. So I think when I first started this project, the broad question I started with was, why does higher education in America cost so much just in general? And the reason I wanted to ask that question is because increasingly we have all these debates about student debt, about this affordability crisis. What is the government going to do? What's the court going to allow the administration to do? And I want to take a step back and ask, well, how did we accumulate as a society so much debt on a good that should be increasing productivity? So in other words, like if the system was working, this debt shouldn't be a problem. And why does it keep getting worse? And why do schools keep costing more? You know, if the definition of technology is doing more with less, then higher education is the exact opposite of technology because it's doing less with more resources. It's costing more, and arguably the quality of the education is getting worse. And so the question was, well, why? Why in a time where the information environment has changed so dramatically, and so therefore technology should be allowing way more leverage for institutions of education, are we seeing the exact opposite? And as I started the book, I started with this very general frame, which is why does it cost so much? And I started to narrow on, well, actually the reason is because elite colleges have sort of rigged a lot of the system and it ends up affecting the entire system. It ends up affecting the public schools. It ends up affecting, you know, the less prestigious schools, the more, you know, sort of skills oriented schools. And the whole system is sort of built around the incumbent power of these handful of schools at the top. And the reason I went with a book is because I wanted to be able to completely lay out my view of what was going wrong in a completely comprehensive way before I was able to go on podcasts like this and really explain, you know, why I think things are so broken, how they can change. And I've found that writing has really helped me clarify my thinking. And taking a long time to sit and write all of this analysis through has tremendously helped my ability to articulate a broader vision. I did. So I went to Georgetown, and that was one of the reasons, that was like one of the impetuses for me to write this book. And now I'm at Columbia Law School, which is also an elite school. And that was, again, a massive impetus for me to write this book. And so one of the things I say in the book is, you know, one of my formative experiences was when I was at Georgetown, the Varsity Blues scandal broke. And so essentially there was a girl in my grade whose father had bribed through an intermediary, the tennis coach at Georgetown, to have his daughter pose as a tennis player, even though there's no record of her ever being a tennis athlete. And she was essentially granted admission through this back channel. And when that scandal broke, I remember the feeling on campus wasn't some sort of like outrage over the fact that wealth had been used to open a door open at Georgetown. That was quite normalized, actually. Instead, the internal on the campus amongst the students, the internal outrage was that her parents had been some sort of like uncouth or cheap or like in violation of social norms because they hadn't done it the right way. They hadn't just paid a donation instead of a bribe. And so therefore it was seen as this sort of violation of social norms. But if you went and read some of the outside reporting, it was a very, very different perspective on that whole scandal. And to me, that was a really eye-opening moment because it kind of showed me like we're living in two very different worlds. There's something completely broken with the culture within campuses, the administrative level, the student level, that is perceiving the same set of events in such a disconnected and frankly, just shocking way.
Well, you know, I went to Clarkson as an undergrad, so not quite elite, but elite adjacent, mm-hmm. getting there. And you know, it was made very clear to me that I could go there because I was female, because they were looking to break the. No, I don't want to say norm, but the perception that everybody here is a white guy. And so they're going to let a white girl in and that's going to be a big difference, right? Like, cool, cool. And I went because I needed to get out of my house. Like it was far enough away from home for me. That guy, like that was the thing. But it's a hockey school and there's really bad hockey players that end up at Clarkson just because they played hockey. And I remember thinking like, why are you at college? Like, you know, you're not here to learn. You're just marking time between hockey practices and hockey games. And I was the photographer for the campus newspaper and events office. And so I attended a lot of hockey games, and I'm a terrible, like, sports ball is not my thing. But so I got to know them. And the number of them who were like, yeah, no, I was like, what classes you're taking? They're like, I don't know. What are you doing? What are you doing? Somebody else could be warming that seat. What are you doing? And their answer was, I'm playing hockey, you know? Yeah. And so I hear you on that social norm idea. It's not quite the same. I think more that I didn't know about it, you know?
Well, but I mean, I think the hockey example is really good because if you look at some of, like, you know, I think, like, it's a very similar type of story where if you look at some of the elite schools like Harvard or something, I mean, they have a sailing team, they have a squash team, they have these sports that essentially, like, a very select demographic plays, namely, like, very wealthy people. And it's sort of this way to allow wealthy people to have a leg up in admissions without admitting that that's what they're doing. Because to be quite frank, no one goes and watches the squash game and no one watches the team sail. And there are all these different sports in which there is essentially no revenue for the school. So they can't even make that type of justification. And it's clearly just a form of, like, affirmative action, policy that's in reverse. And, you know, there are all sorts of ways in which admissions are skewed in this way. So legacy admissions, I think, is one of them. You know, early decision is certainly one of them. And in all of these ways, you end up skewing who has the opportunity to attend these schools. And it's to your point, you know, someone else could have been warming that seat. You know, one of the things that I find in the book is the people who benefit most from access to this elite signal is people whose parents had never gone to college, who otherwise wouldn't have been able to network with the same group of people, who wouldn't have been able to get into those types of highly credentialed jobs and, you know, pull their entire family up in terms of social mobility. And I think, like, if we're thinking about who do we want to be warming these seats, I would posit it's not the squash player, but it is someone who wants to be socially mobile.
It was interesting to me, you know, like I said, Clarkson's a hockey school. And I didn't even know, and I'm not making it up when I say this, I didn't know Clarkson had a soccer team when I went there. Like, and I worked in the news office. I should have known at least that it existed. Like, I saw soccer fields, like, but I never saw anybody on it. That kind of, you know, what I saw is on there's frogs. Frogs on the soccer field. It's a thing. I don't know. Anybody who's gone to Clarkson has seen them. It's really, don't drive down that road certain times in the spring, let me just say. But I learned that there was a soccer team because several years after I graduated, there was a murder and the soccer coach was accused. And I was like, what is happening? What a bizarre, like, I should be learning about this because these people are succeeding at things and are learning things or are raising the caliber of soccer at Clarkson or something. And instead I'm learning about it because some guy got accused of a murder. Like, it was wild, you know? So coming up in the 90s was Title IX. That was the big deal, was to start to equalize men and women's sports. And so while I was there, they dropped the JV hockey team, the men's JV hockey team at Clarkson, and created the women's team. And I, God love them, they were so bad. Like, they were, you know, I hired to take photos of them and getting action shots when there's no action was a challenge, you know. Mm-hmm. And now they're excellent. And so I'm not at all saying that was a bad, like, it's got to start somewhere, but right. I just feel like the whole sports thing is wild. Moving to present day, one of the schools that my husband teaches up, the private elite school, has a, you know, visual quotes, baseball team. Like, nobody's ever heard of their baseball team. It's just a way to get the kid into the school, right? And so my husband teaches math, and his class is two evenings a week. He's had a kid miss the past 5 consecutive classes. This is not a kid who's in school.
Right.
you know, and I look at this and I'm like, you know what, this kid's going to own a business someday. I don't want him owning a business, but that's how, you know, power accumulates power rather than spreading it out and getting new perspectives and maybe having somebody actually have new ideas. What a concept.
Right. And to your point, I think, you know, one of the issues is it would be one thing if you had all this sports recruitment and legacy admissions and early decision and all these other things that are quite anti-diversity, if there were an ever-growing number of seats so that you could have those kids, plus you're making room for other types of people. But the sad fact that the world we live in is one of complete scarcity. So at the top 25 schools, enrollments have virtually stagnated. And this is in large part to how they've structured their own market. And so what the elite schools have done is they've struck a bargain with US News and World Report that's quite implicit in nature, where the rankings work to create scarcity amongst the schools. And so if you're a school like Georgetown or Columbia, and you say tomorrow, like, let me triple my enrollment, let me build a new campus, you're going to get tanked in the rankings. And the reason is because the rankings are weighted by the amount of spending per student. So the less students, the higher you go. The more you spend, the higher you go. It's ranked around selectivity. So the more people you reject, the higher you go. It's ranked around class sizes. So the less students you accept, the higher you go. And all these different ways, the rankings create these incentives for system-wide scarcity. And when the Obama administration tried to reform the system by creating a competing government ranking, the elite schools lobbied to kill the effort. Anytime someone tries to displace the US News, the elite schools rally behind it and kill the effort. And it's because they understand that this hub is a tremendously valuable asset because it creates incentives for all of them to stay quite anti-competitive in their admissions policies. Because if you're not expanding enrollment, then Harvard and Yale aren't competing that much over the marginal applicant. So prices don't have to come down. You don't have to come up with an interesting way to teach. You don't have to show any improvement on the campus. All you need to do is sort of harvest the brand name. And that's essentially what the higher education system has become. And now the real issue with this is, yes, it's bad for the nation that we're not getting the right people into our top 25 schools. But admittedly, that's only like 2% of college enrollment. You know, I think one of the bigger issues with this is that this sort of like spending pathology that the top schools have sort of formalized into the rankings ends up infecting everyone else. So now if you're UVA and you're competing with Penn, you have to figure out more ways to raise revenue so that you can compete for that marginal student. And then if you're Virginia Tech and you're competing with UVA, now you need to figure out more ways to get revenue so you can compete for that marginal student. And so what we've seen at public universities across the nation is that people from their own states often can't get in. And the reason is because some wealthy person from China or from Europe, someone who's going to treat it like a vacation, comes to these schools and displaces that marginal student from the state itself. And it is in large part because the state legislatures have capped the amount of money the schools can get from an in-state student, but have left unbounded the amount of money that they can get from everyone else. So they've created this perverse incentive for the state schools to become more and more exclusionary to the very taxpayers who've held them up on their shoulders for so many years. I think, you know, when this starts to happen at Virginia Tech, at UVA, at JMU, eventually things get completely out of control, where all of these schools start to get super expensive. And this is partly where the debt problem comes from, which is there's all this pressure pulling prices up. Everyone's borrowing money across the board, no matter what institution you go to. And that turns out, well, you can't afford to pay back that debt because you borrowed way too much. And it's completely disproportionate to any amount of actual education. You know, at some public schools, in order to attract, like, you know, tourists from Europe, they've built like lazy pools. They've built like all sorts of like luxury amenities because that's who they're appealing to. They're appealing to people who want to treat this as a vacation. And to your point about who's going to warm the seats, it's precisely the wrong mindset. And so it's deranged the culture on all sorts of campuses, not just the elite ones. And the system, so therefore put in place by the elite schools, has extended its tentacles all over and destabilized and destroyed the state of higher education in America.
Well, there's something too about you know, an 18-year-old, give or take, couldn't realistically get a good loan for a house or a decent car or, you know, to start up a business, things like that. But no problem, they can get loans for $150,000 a year for school. And listen, I have four kids. I can tell you, 18-year-olds, they don't know anything about debt. Like, they just don't. It's too, you know, it's too abstract and it's too tangential to their lives in the moment. And so the whole concept of student debt, it's dangerous.
And it's unbelievably cynical because in large part, it's the universities that lobby to continually increase the credit and to make it dischargeable. So if you get hooked on student debt, you're hooked for life. You can't declare bankruptcy to get out of it. There's nothing you can do to not to free yourself from this burden. It's killing entrepreneurship. It's killing homeownership. It's killing upward mobility. In all these ways, it's a complete drag on the future of this country, where we're spending all of this money. We're making kids take out all of this debt on something that's fundamentally unproductive, a debt asset in many ways, because what they're paying for that education is not what it's really worth, in large part because a lot of the money is being spent wastefully on ever more administrators, on ever more luxury amenities, things that have nothing to do with the education itself.
When I was in grad school, so I have, you know, bachelor's, two masters and a doctorate. So I have a little bit of an addiction to student debt, I guess, but education myself, they're all, you know, sort of different degrees. And I would beg to differ that there is one special way to escape student debt that I discovered, which was to break my back and land on full disability. Don't do that. Like, that's a terrible, terrible way to have your debt discharged. It's awful. And I would love to have my debt back and return to work. That being said, when I was in my doctoral program, so this would have been the early 2000s, you know, there's that point in time where everybody's sort of visiting the bursar's office, visiting the student loan office, talking to their advisors, getting stuff signed up. And I was talking to a friend of mine, and I'm not going to drop his name only because I don't have his permission to do so. But he's like, yeah, no, I paid outright for the tuition. You know, I had it, but I took the student loan anyway, because the interest on the student loan is lower. And so I'm just using that as a money earner. And I remember just thinking, like, that was the first time, I was probably 24, 25 years old. I was already a mother. I was already a homeowner at that point. And that was the first time that I really thought of student debt as dollars. And I remember thinking, like, oh, that's not good. You know what I mean? Like, that's, I should have thought about these as dollars, as money, a long time ago. And I just didn't somehow.
Right. Well, and, you know, I think there's something in our culture that makes it quite taboo to talk about the cost of education. And I think, I won't say this is exclusively because of the schools. I think it's something that's broader in the culture, but it's in some part because of the schools. I remember in researching the book, I was looking into this antitrust case that the Department of Justice filed against the Ivy League schools in the 1990s. And it was known as the Ivy Overlap case then. Essentially, they accused them of fixing prices on financial aid, something they'd been doing since the 60s. And what the school said was, well, you can't treat us like we're selling toasters or we're selling tires. Education isn't in commerce. It's own thing. It's not a good in a tangible way. And it's sort of to your point, Kate, about, you know, not thinking of this as dollars. There are all these ways in which our culture sort of treats this as something apart from commerce. And, you know, look, I'm the first person to acknowledge that education is a special thing, right? It opens up your mind to all sorts of opportunities, allows you to expand, you know, your degrees of freedom in terms of what you're able to do, what you can accomplish, what you can dream. But at the same time, degrees, the business of education, is absolutely about dollars. And, you know, I think it was like Mark Twain, who said something like, don't let your schooling interfere with your education. I think that's the right frame that we should be espousing. Something a little bit more cynical to the business of education, but much more sympathetic to the spirit of education. And I think we've gotten it exactly reversed.
My oldest went to a private school. They just graduated last year. And they went because it had an art program, and they are an artist, and when I say single-minded, like, I laser focus doesn't begin to accept, like, that's the only school they applied to, and it was solely because of the art program. And they would have gone if it had been a community college. They would have gone if it had been a bunch of cows in a pasture. Like, it was the art that just pulled them through, and it happened to have been an elite school. But all of their friends were, you know, would come over to the house after school or whatever. And I remember some of their friends being so intensely anxious about what schools am I going to apply to, and how am I going to decide where to go? And, you know, the rankings of the schools and the acceptance rate. They would talk about the acceptance rate to me, about how important that was, that they get into a school with a low acceptance rate. And I remember being like, please, for the love of all that you hold dear, shut up and listen to yourself for a second. Stop reading into whatever your parents or these newspapers are telling you, and think about, where are you going to learn things? Not, you know, nobody ever asks you. Once you graduate high school, nobody, you know, when you start college, nobody ever asks you, where'd you go to high school? Until you get on Facebook, and then that's its own thing. And once you get into your, you know, post-grad, whether it's a master's or law degree or whatever, nobody ever asks you, well, where'd you go for your first 2 years of college? And once you go for your doctorate, nobody ever asks you, where'd you get your master's? Do you know what I'm saying? And so it's this false sense of glamour, you know, it's just that's great that somebody, you know, puts a name on a diploma, but nobody cares. Nobody cares. And I remember them coming back after the first year and being like, yeah, I'm overpaying for what I'm getting. Yeah, nobody cares.
Yeah. So I will agree entirely with the spirit of what you're saying. I would disagree slightly on the notion that nobody cares. Here's what I would say. Here's how I'd split the difference between us. I think it's absolutely true that if you go on after your undergrad and go get a graduate degree or a postdoc or something like this, that it does not matter whatsoever. The one thing I would posit, though, is that where you graduate from does matter in terms of certain jobs, certain vocations. And so, for example, you know, there's a lot of evidence that if you want to go into consulting or some knowledge economy sectors, or if you want to go into investment banking or something like this, you know, these sort of like very tracked professions, that there's a high emphasis placed on where you graduated from. And this shows up in the economic data. So, for example, I mentioned earlier, for students whose parents didn't go to college, if they went to an elite school, a very prestigious school, there was a greater career earnings jump that they were able to accomplish, in part because of this mechanism. And you're right, what you learn should matter more. But unfortunately, a lot of employers in these sort of like incumbent markets don't really care so much about what people actually know. So what ends up happening is they hire exclusively based on prestige, and they basically just harvest that and build that out to clients. And so there are all these ways in which one broken market, like those specific sectors, end up infecting the education market, which ends up infecting, you know, the culture of applying to colleges, because everyone really does start to care about that credentialism. And that's how you start to get these like very hyper-competitive races that drive all sorts of crazy behavior. And so I'll tell you a brief example from my high school experience, which is there was a girl at my high school who claimed to have gotten into both Harvard and Stanford. And she claimed that she was so special that she'd actually gotten the two schools to agree to let her graduate from both or something like this by spending 2 years at each. And when people started to question her story, she had she or someone close to her impersonated a Harvard math professor and sent an email to the entire senior class at my high school saying that, and I'm paraphrasing, but saying something like, "We know more than you. You guys should stop spreading rumors," things like this. "This girl is very qualified," or something like this. And so, I mean, that just increased the skepticism more, because why would a Harvard math professor ever care about some rumor circulating in some faraway high school? And why would he care to the extent that he would send an email to the entire senior class? And so there are all these ways in which, once the lie started rolling, it had to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. The girl claimed at one point that Mark Zuckerberg had called her to convince her to go to Stanford. And the real tragedy of the situation was all of this was being reported in the press because someone had alerted the South Korean news outlets, like international news outlets, that this girl had gotten into both and that there's this really special deal they were doing for it. And she was of South Korean heritage. And so international news outlets were parked outside of my high school asking many of us if we knew the, quote, genius girl that she'd been dubbed in the South Korean press. And eventually this infected the domestic press. The Washington Post covered this, CNN covered this, and it became quite the local scandal. And eventually Stanford and Harvard both came out in the press, said the girl had never gotten in, and her parents had to go out in the press and sort of apologize for the conduct of their daughter and things like this. And so at the time, the way this was rationalized at my high school was, you know, what a crazy person, why would she lie like this, things like this. But obviously, the older I get, you know, I would always flip that situation around, which is, what is the set of incentives that have been created that are driving such madness on campuses and high schools across America? Because it's not just that girl, right? We earlier spoke about Varsity Blues, which was a formative experience for me. There's another story of a girl who pretended to be a Stanford student for many months before security found her jumping in and out of an empty dorm room window, which is where she'd been pretending to live, and while pretending to go to class and all of these other things. So there's this like collective madness that has been getting worse and worse and worse. And it seems like we see admission scandals every single year now, where it wasn't the case that this was, you know, such a fact of life in the 80s or the 70s, and certainly even into the 90s, it wasn't so common to hear these things every single year. But now everyone has a nonprofit and everyone's doing X, Y, and Z extracurriculars. And there's more and more convergence in what students across America are doing in order to get into the schools. It's becoming this sort of hyper-competitive rat race, which is really quite, I think, quite bad. We're not letting young people even figure out who they are yet. And it's turning into something that's incredibly toxic as a way to allocate not only prestige, esteem, but also access to those job opportunities that I mentioned earlier, which unfortunately do seem to place some sort of preference on prestige.
No, I think I would agree. You know, there is a prestige and a glamour, and people lie on their admissions packets, and they lie to their friends, and they push, and they get cutthroat. And what I had tried to, the message I tried to send to my kids' friends and my own kids was that it feels like the end of the world.
Right.
If you don't get into your top school in the moment, but let it sit for a little while and go to your second choice, go to a community college. Don't go for a little while and maybe see what life hands you, rather than, I mean, basically you're paying for ink on a diploma, and I don't think ink is worth that much.
I couldn't agree with you more. One of the things I hope that we can get out of conversations like this is that people can start to recognize that, where we can start to reform things that, you know, the federal policy level, state policy levels, and governor's races and congressional races. Because I think it's super important. I mean, it's to your point about, you know, the availability of credit for student debt, which also incentivizes people to go to schools because it's a cheaper rate of interest than other endeavors. It's to your point about all these ways in which there's this hypermania surrounding college. And there's this sort of like college bubble almost amongst youngsters who feel like it is the end of the world because this is what everyone tells them to do. And so I really hope that as a nation, we can steer away from that. And one of the things I talk about in the book is one of the ways we can bring that about is by breaking some of the established power centers that sort of perpetuate all sorts of these types of policies. And so one of the things I talk about in the book is breaking up the endowments potentially at the elite colleges and redistributing those resources in ways that make other schools stronger so that you have a much more vibrant and competitive college ecosystem, maybe seeding new schools, things that we haven't really seen since like the early 1900s, which is when like UChicago and Caltech and the last of the new elite colleges were endowed. I mean, today, when was the last time you heard about an elite college startup? It never really happens anymore. And so I think all of these ways we're living in this sort of like very stagnant, very static, very broken world. And I think it's time for dynamism. And the frame I offer in the book is, what would Teddy Roosevelt do if he was confronting this problem? What would Woodrow Wilson do? What would Franklin Roosevelt do? I think it's time we get back to some of those really great American traditions of jumpstarting dynamism in stagnant and stale sectors, of taking on entrenched interests as opposed to accommodating them, legislating for them, and sort of, you know, essentially embracing them.
Do you feel yourself being pulled more in the direction of, you said you're studying law now. Do you feel that you're being pulled more toward the practice of law, or do you feel more like you're going to end up in politics, or both?
So I think there's an interesting intersection that I've been exploring so far. I mean, you know, I think one of the areas of law that I think for a very long time has been a little bit static, but has great traditions in America is this area of antitrust. And I think, you know, it's in some part political, it's in some part, you know, legal. But I think above all, it's something that is incredibly necessary. And so one of the things that I'm exploring is, well, how can we use these laws and really vigorously enforce them in a way that hasn't been done in a generation since like the Microsoft case in the 2000s or, you know, the AT&T breakup of like 1984. I mean, things that are almost a world away at this point. For many people, they haven't really seen the power of this tool in a very, very long time. And I think there are all these ways in which it could be used. And so what I'm working on, obviously, with this book, what I'm working on this summer at a think tank in D.C., and what I'd like to continue to work on, at least for the foreseeable few years, is building out a toolkit and creating a set of proposals that can be taken quite seriously and could maybe, you know, under the right administration, be implemented.
Do you think we could get that, the right administration?
I think we're going to get there. I think, you know, a lot of these, you know, there's this sort of inevitability narrative that I don't like, which is that something is definitely going to happen. And I certainly don't like the alternative, which is that something can never happen. I think a lot of things are much closer than we imagine and are essentially questions of agency, which is, you know, I don't know that we would have broken Standard Oil, but for people in that Roosevelt administration. I don't know that we would have gone for AT&T or gone for IBM or gone for Microsoft or gone for a lot of the entrenched monopolies in America, but for people in positions who actually took those roles incredibly seriously, people we've, you know, completely forgotten the names of, who were lost to history, but who left behind a tremendous legacy of public service. And so I think these questions of agency sort of get forgotten because we write history in a certain way. But I think it's always a question of agency. And that's the thing that I'm really interested in.
Don't follow the established path. That's easy to say. A lot of us like to say, you know, I'm a rule breaker. I don't do what I'm told. But we do. And we value the things we're told to value because that's how the brain works. And so learning about how broken the system is and learning how to let go of this concept of prestige and focus more on the concept of actual education from your fellow students and from your professors and from the experience, I think that's a really big deal. So, Sahaj, thank you so much for coming to play. I wish you all the luck in the world out there. You know, I am not always big on politics and political discussions because you just never know and it can be touchy and I don't understand the bigger system very well, but I feel like I understand a slice of the system better after this conversation. So I really appreciate it. Thank you guys for listening. It's coming up on graduation time for a lot of people with a lot of kids, or I suppose the occasional kid actually listens to the show. So I hope this gave a little bit of food for thought, maybe. But again, I want to loop back to how I started the episode. You don't need to go to college at all to be successful in this world. You need to take care of you and find things that make you happy and feel productive and functional in your own way. That's my definition of success. You matter.